Okay, let's get started. We have a lot of history to cover. We're going to go back to the creation of the universe. I've gotten a number of requests over the years to do something on creation and existence of God, and I've done a few things. Considering our white elephants next week, and it's going to be hard to kind of develop a series out of 1 Peter, I thought I'd take a little time and talk about God and creation. Okay, so in my Western Civ course, we talk about the existence of God, and one of the questions that always comes up is, well, what about science? Because it looks like the two are contradictory. And I usually wind up telling people, don't believe everything you hear about science, and don't believe everything you hear about God either, because you don't always get the accurate picture. That was driven home this week, if you saw the emails on global warming that got released. The institution that gets $28 million in taxpayer money basically has been fraudulently doctoring the results, saying we have to throw garbage in to get the, you know, the thing warming. And yesterday I went up to a, I attended a seminar at Foundation for Economic Education called FEE in upstate Irvington, New York. And they had a Harvard professor, Wally Soon, and he presented some very interesting science that shed a lot of light on the issue. A couple things that I remember from it. I was actually sitting behind a wall, so I couldn't see his overheads. But one of the things that he said is that there are like over 1,000 of these temperature sensors that are scattered throughout our world. And they go down in the ocean on some regularly scheduled basis and record temperatures as it goes down. And then they come up and transmit that data, and it basically shows the Earth environment is kind of constant. And he had a bunch of others in terms of fluctuations in Earth temperature and things like that. But the piece that I thought was really fascinating was they did some cores, I think vice, and these things reveal incontrovertibly that throughout history, there has been an increase in the temperature of the Earth, followed by an increase in carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide does not cause any type of global warming. If anything, it's a result of it. When Al Gore and company put together a children's book on this subject, they took this graph, and to make it work, they flipped it. So it was backwards. So it looked like carbon dioxide preceded rises in the Earth's temperature, which fluctuate. When this professor wrote to Scholastic Publishing about it to say, you know, why are you doing this? They hired someone to basically say, well, yeah, the graph's wrong, but everything else that we derive from the graph when it's backwards is correct. So you kind of get the idea that maybe science isn't exactly accurate, unbiased. You know, sometimes there used to be the joke, the difference between a used car salesman and a computer salesman, is that the car salesman knows when he's lying. These computers got some more complicated, people didn't even understand them. But there's a lot of very simple stuff to understand, and we're going to look at a few of these things. One of the reasons I kind of have hesitated to do anything like this, it's more seminar material than a sermon material, is, does it really make any difference if God created the heavens and the earth? No. Is that really going to impact the way we live our lives? I think it makes a huge amount of difference that we are created rather than self-caused. But you might want to think about, is it going to affect the way you live next week, better understanding or incontrovertibly seeing that God, incontrovertibly seeing, created us? Well, maybe, maybe not. Do you think people actually decide to accept Christ because they understand that Noah's Ark is more plausible than not? I'm not sure if these things make a huge difference. But Genesis 1:1 says that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and I think it's kind of worth explaining a little bit about that. And then when Luke was writing his first gospel, actually his first work, he also wrote Acts, to a guy called Theophilus. He said, I'm writing this that you might know the certainty of those things in which you have been instructed. So it seems like there's good biblical precedent for going back and establishing the certainty of things that people have been taught. A couple of theology textbook, it's called Prolegomena, some words that happened before, are found in number one. We really want to know about truth. You know, what really happened? What really goes on? What's the real scoop? And truth, as you know, is not determined by what you believe, or how sincere you are in that belief, or something that you feel or experience, or even a majority opinion, but it's that which best explains all the facts. And one of the things that science is infamous for, excluding those facts which don't fit the theories. I would also say that this is one of those things that theologians are also infamous for. They have a verse that they can't explain, but we just don't deal with that. So, you know, both sides are guilty of not really trying to understand the truth, which is that which best explains all the facts. One of the problems of this is that it's hard to get all the facts. But fortunately, the scripture is a little easier. It's got 66 books. They're there. They're readable. They're understandable. And if you suspend all judgment until you go through the whole 66 of them, and then you start putting it together, what does it really say? You have a good chance of arriving at truth. When I do my courses, we look at truth throughout history, discovered at the convergence of three things. Number one is revelation, authenticated revelation. Is there some sort of supernatural communication that's entered this world? And if so, I want to know that it's got a good basis behind it. So I want to see something that shows it came from outside this world. We look at reason, what's logically consistent. And then we look at reality. Does it really work? Is it in accord with the natural laws that we observe around us all the time? And if you can triangulate these three ideas, so they all line up on one thing, you have a good idea that this is something that's true. And it's unlikely it's going to be something else. People ask, can you prove God exists? And a question I'm fond of responding to is, well, what kind of proof do you want? You know, what about if in the sky every morning there was this thing that said, God exists? Would that do it? Well, actually in the sky every morning and at night there are these things that actually do say God exists, if you understand the tolerances and all that stuff. It's like people would just ignore it. You know, so we have a billboard that shows up in Times Square that magically appears. Maybe it'd be a holograph, who knows? It says God exists. I'm not really sure that just convincing people that God exists makes the difference, because we're going to see a little bit later at the end of this that most people aren't that interested. They don't want to have a God in their lives, except when they run into problems. But what kind of proof do you want that God exists? Do you want scientific proof? Scientific proof is a little difficult because it has to be observable, repeatable, in a controlled environment. None of you can prove scientifically that you were born. Think about that. Observe it. Well, videotape. That could be photoshopped. Is it repeatable? You can't go back and repeat that kind of thing. In a controlled environment, well, you know, who knows what was going on. What we do is we reason that we were born. Think about it. We look at everybody who walks around the planet, and every time we see a person walking around the planet, we realize that we assume that they were born, because that's how we see people come onto this planet. And therefore we make the inference, we were born. But that's a function of reasoning. It's not science. It's more the legal historical proof. There's some evidence, there's reason. And you cannot prove that you were born scientifically. You actually cannot observe it and repeat it. So most of the proof that we deal with in our lives is more the legal historical proof. So again, what would hold up in a court of law? What kind of evidence do we have? Let's apply a little reason to it. And see, is it more reasonable to believe A or B? Now, I would maintain that anybody who doesn't believe what I believe is unreasonable. I know it sounds arrogant, and maybe it is, but I have reasons for my belief. I think all Christians should have reasons for their belief, and I think we should all be on the same page, because truth is truth. And as you know, sometimes I've held beliefs or concepts that I haven't examined, and I realize, oh, that's not reasonable. But eventually, you can explain everything, because God gave us reason. He's a reasonable God. He does things decently in order. It doesn't mean there aren't mysteries of some sort, but all the stuff I need to know is stuff I can understand and act upon. So that's the prelude. Let's start with where I frequently start when I'm trying to talk with someone, is I ask the question, do we live in a material or an immaterial world? And most of my students who can spell those words say, material. And I say, well, what about a thought or a concept or an idea? If you took a human body and dissected it, can you pull up a sentence, a paragraph? It's like, you don't find that. It's an immaterial kind of thing. You can find the mechanism for maybe, you know, storing it or communicating it, but like, there's no real thing. You say, ah, there is the word, the. It's not there. It's an immaterial concept. I also look through history at some of these people who claim to have revelation. You get Joan of Arc, Hildegard von Bingham, and you know, a bunch of other folks. And like, where'd this stuff come from? There's a fascinating lady in history called Hildegard von Bingham. I might have mentioned this, that the first Renaissance man was actually a woman. She lived 1300, somewhere like that. And yeah, she was a botanist. I have some of her early music. I'm a fan of early music. And I've got one of her discs. Probably wasn't originally done as a disc. I've seen references to her in herbal stuff that I read. She writes theology. She, you know, ran an abbess. You know, she's just an amazing, amazing woman. And she had these voices and lights and everything, and people said, oh, she suffered from migraines. Well, I have some friends who suffer from migraines, and I know that when they are having a migraine, they don't write books. That makes sense. They look for a dark room where they can be quiet. You know, it's like, so, yeah, this, and people have, go look her up on Wikipedia and they'll say, oh yeah, so-and-so, is, the scientific community has concluded that she really suffered from a condition of migraines. It's like, all of us should have such migraines. You know, that would be really wonderful. So anyway, there's this immaterial part to our world. There's also a material part. And if you understand E equals MC squared, you realize that energy kind of takes hold of matter at the speed of light squared, which kind of messes up all your physics. But the world at its root is immaterial. And as I understand what's going to happen in the future, all this other stuff that we see as material is going to go poof one day. So John 4:24, Jesus said, God's a spirit. He's immaterial. And those of us who worship him must obviously do that in spirit or truth. The people who say that God doesn't exist are actually almost being claiming to be God, because they're claiming to be omniscient. And I've kind of done this in some of the apologetic stuff. I would conclude that there are no honest atheists. They're only ignorant agnostics. An agnostic is a person who says, I don't know. They are unknowledgeable. And the reason I have ignorant in quotes there is they are choosing to ignore some really clear evidence. Most people who don't want to answer a question say, oh, I don't know. Let's go a little further down. A verse that a lot of you have drawn some comfort from is Psalm 139:13. Addressing God, the psalmist writes, you did form me, or form my inward parts. You did knit me together in my mother's womb, CRSV. This word for knit together, I always used to get a kick at when I thought of it. I always thought of God there with knitting needles, you know, kind of putting people together. But as I started doing a little more research into DNA and how it works, I thought, that's really amazing. It kind of is how we are knit together with these long strands of protein. Remember when they knit? It's like one substance that gets wound around each other and gets yarn, and then that gets put together in things, and that's actually how we're kind of wired together. It's really fascinating. So let's start with, after you get to the material and immaterial world, and we say we think, therefore we are, you have to get to the point where anything that exists is either created or eternal. Don't we see a chair? Has that chair always been there? Nah, I just put it there. Well, how about the very fact of it being a chair? Did it just kind of pop into existence as a chair? No, somebody made it. It was created. So there's pretty good agreement that that chair was not self-cause. It was not eternal. It was created. Okay, how about us? Are we self-caused or created? The question at the top of your sheet is really one of the fundamental questions of life. I don't know about you, but I think I'm mortal. You probably think I'm mortal too. But I can't cause my existence. I have no control over the fact that I was born here. And I really have relatively little control over the time of my departure, unless I jump off big buildings or, you know, blow myself up. I can't just say, okay, I'm going to die now, and that's it. I don't have that capacity or ability. I'm a dependent being. I didn't just pop into existence. So anything that exists was either created or eternal. How about our universe? Created or eternal? I get a kick when I'm going through my course because I've got one chapter on Thomas Aquinas, and he synthesizes Aristotelian thought with Christianity, and he shows that it's reasonable, and it's called the Thomas synthesis or something like that. And then the next chapter basically goes on to say, well, Aristotle and Christianity differ on a number of issues, therefore the synthesis doesn't hold, and Aristotle's right, Christianity's wrong. So I look at what they say the difference was. Aristotle said that the universe was eternal. How do you know that? Yeah, obviously it's not a science thing because, yeah, you kind of go up there and take a look at it. It's kind of a reason thing. And most people up until 1950 used to say universe is eternal. Then we came out, which was 1949, with the announcement of the Big Bang Theory. That's when it was first called that. And just to get a little perspective, I went back and looked at some stuff on it. And somebody was talking about the universe expanding and if we as humans can do anything to stop that. And the guy who answered him on this blog said, you dolt, don't you realize the universe is so much bigger than us? And then he says, it really came from a dot. I wonder who the dolt is here. Yeah, there was this really, really small dot. And it exploded, and then that gave rise to the suns, which gave rise to all the chemicals that we have, and then, you know, everything just continued. Really now? A little exploding dot. Okay, even if we had that, how did dot get there? It was always there. Is the universe eternal or not? Well, most people will say now it had a beginning. And this actually gets kind of funny. Universe had a beginning. It's called the Big Bang Theory. So we go out. Notice it says theory. We go out and we look at the stars. And we see that the stars that are further away from us, I'm going to draw this on the board, are moving a whole lot faster than the stars are near us. So I got a star here. The distance from me to that star is, you know, velocity 1. Got a star that's twice as far, and the velocity at which that's moving is 2 times v. You know, it's twice as fast. And the one that's out there 4 times as far away is moving 4 times as fast. So you get the idea that everything, if you back it up, started here and then expanded. All right, yeah, that's observable. You know, there are people who will debate the red phase shift and all kinds of other stuff, but yeah, maybe it makes sense. So there had to be a beginning. That's good. My Bible says, in the beginning, God created this stuff. It had a beginning. So now all science believes that the universe had a beginning. Or, yeah, I think there are probably still a few people who believe the Earth is flat that probably are still in the science realm based on my understanding of science, but most of them say, okay, it had a beginning. All right, now this thing is expanding. Some things are slowing down. It keeps going, going, going. And it supposedly happened for, you know, it's a long, long time. But they kind of went out there and they kind of discovered that when stars have lunch, they eat hydrogen. And when they burp, you get helium. All right, so stars combust hydrogen to helium. And so if you go out there and you take your little sample bottle and you sling it around in space and you bring it back to the lab and say, what do we have in here? We should have lots of helium. Oh, no, it's mainly hydrogen. So if all these stars have been burning for all this time, you'd expect that the atmosphere out there would be full of helium because that's a byproduct of combustion. By the way, our sun is getting smaller and smaller. Did you know this as it does its thing? And if you kind of back it up, to make it big enough to account for the apparent age of the universe, Earth would have been a poached egg. It would have been boiled. So, you know, so it's like it couldn't have existed forever and ever. It's just got a while. So anyway, we basically have to deal with the fact that we got all this hydrogen out there. And so
Stephen Hawking's the guy in the wheelchair who talks like this, who's kind of a little bitter about life, has come up with a theory.
He's one of the people who proposed this. I'm not sure who came up with it. That we have the oscillating universe. So the thing expanded. It gets further and further and further apart from this little dot. And it gets so far out that eventually it then starts contracting. So, boom, goes out, and then, okay, kind of comes back, just like a big rubber band. Excuse me, Dr. Hawking, when was the last time we observed this contraction?
Well, we haven't actually observed it. It's a theory.
Oh, so it's not science.
Right.
And isn't it true that when things get further and further apart from each other, the gravitational pull gets less and less? So the mechanism for them actually ever coming back together again is decreasing?
Smartass.
So, you know, we've got this theory that actually doesn't fit everything that we know about science. Because we never see things popping into existence from nothing. You know, it's like those always kind of causes. In fact, my good friend Aristotle said that, apart from the fact that he was long ago in the universe, he basically said, everything we see around us has a cause. And in order for it to exist, it has to have been caused. And he goes back to saying you can't have an infinite set of causes. So otherwise it wouldn't exist. So if there's no cause, it doesn't exist. And yeah, you might be right about that. In my class, I had people read some excerpts, just one, two pages out of Summa Theologica by Thomas Aquinas. And he gives arguments for and against the existence of God. And I ask my students to kind of read it and, you know, give me an argument for or against. I don't really care where they come out on it. I just want to get them thinking, and most of them have trouble with that. Okay, so anything that exists or is created, or exists, is either created or eternal. And most of the evidence is that our universe is not eternal. Hence the need for this oscillating universe theory, which is unproven, so it can't really be science. The first point under this 3A is the reasoning of the philosophers that all things must have a cause. This is called the cosmological argument. We got this cosmos, it's got to have a cause. I tell my students about a book called by Mortimer Adler, who wrote a great book called How to Read a Book. It actually taught me a little bit about how to analyze a piece of literature. And because I liked that one so much, when I was in a used bookstore, I saw his book called How to Think About God. I'll pick this up. This is the guy who edited the Encyclopedia Britannica. So he's not exactly an intellectual slouch. In fact, in the days before the internet, when I wanted to find out what any classical author said on a subject, I would go to these two big volumes, about 3 inches thick, 8.5 by 11 almost, called the Synopticon. And in this, Mortimer, and I'm sure a staff of grad students, had taken all classical literature and put it under headings. So if I wanted to know what Aristotle or Plato or Sophocles said about rhetoric, I could go under the rhetoric and I'd see listings to it. So the guy's kind of, you know, got a lot going for him. Plus, I think he was a professor of humanities and philosophy out at University of Chicago. He was a non-practicing Jew married to a Protestant or Catholic with a Protestant daughter, something like that. So their dinner conversations must have been really interesting, probably frustrating to him. So he writes a book on it. And he wants to go back and look at this question of the existence of God, and he wants to try to find some people who are untainted. So he wants to find pagans. Now, pagans in your dictionary are people who don't believe in the Judeo-Christian God. And he found some people that he called doubly pagan, Aristotle and Plato. Because these guys not only did not believe in the Judeo-Christian God, they didn't believe in the cartoon gods of their current culture. Yet, he concludes, as I give source material in my courses, they believed in God. It's more reasonable to believe in God than not believe in God. So Mortimer concludes by saying the cosmological argument is the best argument. You really can't refute it, but he has one that he thinks is a little better. It's a flip on it, like the fact that things continue to exist is a better argument for the existence of God, but you know, the first one's good enough for me. The fact that they exist, there's got to be a cause for it. But if you really want to look at it more, go look more at Mortimer. I got another one here. Let's see. The old watch must have a designer. This is called a teleological argument. Calliope and Gold design. You know, nobody walking in the woods finding a watch says, oh, it just happened to spring up here. Imagine a fungus that grows a watch. But they look at the thing and see all this intricate design, and they kind of conclude that someone had to design it. And actually, this is one of the things that got me to move from atheism to theism. Because I kind of, my neurobio courses, I saw the brain was put together. I said, wow, that's amazing. I looked at, you know, nature and realized that that's just amazing. And I looked at myself and thought, wow. You know, I was like, how come everything inside me and outside me has all this purpose and order, and me, it's like, I was going nowhere. So it kind of moved me, starting to think, yeah, maybe it does exist. By the way, in my atheist days, I was actually minoring in philosophy to prove that God didn't exist. And I remember taking a biochem course, and I remember sitting there in the lab, trying to flip through my textbook to find something, and I'm realizing, wait a minute, this stuff is hogwash. I probably used a different term back then. And, you know, this doesn't make sense. The scientific theories did not make sense. That we're denying God. Even at the point I was denying God, I realized that science was going to give me no help, because science actually points to the fact that there is a God. Teleological argument is pretty decent. When I gave this on one of my first exams when I was teaching to current students, I used to have a exam question that says, a watch must have a blank, quote, teleological argument. And my students always were asking for word banks, because, yeah, so it's a multiple guess thing, and I didn't want to give them word banks. The answer to this question convinced me I needed to give them a word bank, because when I got the exam back, in that blank, it was, a watch must have a battery. All right. So, no, yeah, the answer is it has to have a designer. You know, it's like, it points to the fact that there's some designer. Intelligent design is probably more intelligent than most people believe, unless you're one of my students. Okay. I think I have on there this little bit about the ontological argument. I threw that in. A guy called Anselm came up with an argument that said, it's really, really simple. Ingenious, in fact. It says, imagine a being greater than nothing exists. So the greatest possible thing you can imagine. And most of us would think about God. And then he says, you know, existence is greater than non-existence. Ergo, therefore, God exists. And so many people have tried to discredit this argument, but you have some great older philosophers who wrote entire books on it. It actually has a lot of merit to it. So if you're sitting on the beach someday, you might want to just ponder that one. It's decent. I don't think it's just semantics. I think there's good logic behind it. Okay, then we get to C, the reality that the abundance of hydrogen in the cosmos. We've talked about that. D, the faster speed of the more distant stars. We talked about that. There's a guy called Gerald Schroeder. .com. We've talked about him in the past. Does a good job on indicating some beginning. And then we have something I remember even from my high school physics courses. I don't remember much from my college physics courses. I was losing too many brain cells then. But the first and second observable laws of thermodynamics are conservation of energy or matter, or entropy. So what I do in my classes is I take a chair and I start pushing it across the floor. And the students who suspect I'm crazy now know. I am. And I said, there, I just did a science experiment. And I said, floating around this room are molecules that came from my burrito that I ate for lunch. Then they know I'm crazy. But I kind of explained that I ate this burrito, it gave me energy. That energy enabled me to push the chair. And the friction that the legs of the chair caused on the floor generated heat that's now floating around the room. Because energy never gets created or lost. It just kind of changes from one form to another. Ditto matter. Matter, never. We've never observed matter just coming into being. Except for when that little dot did the thing. But other than that, you know, that's all science says. Nothing just pops into being. Matter is always conserved. It just changes from one form to the other. You take a piece of wood and burn it. Did it disappear? No, it just kind of went into energy, heat, smoke, ash. You know, it's still there, somewhere in the universe floating around, contributing to global warming. That's the first law of thermodynamics, the conservation of energy or matter, which basically says nothing in science has ever seen matter created. Maybe that would point to a creator? No. Okay, the second one is entropy, and I really like this one because my messy desk and the clothes on the floor of my room are really a scientific law that I am powerless to overcome. It's a law of entropy. It says that things always go from a higher energy state to a lower energy state. Your desk never automatically gets cleaned up. And I tell my students, your clothes never get off your floor, cleaned, and onto the hangers. Unless, of course, your mother's been in your room. It just doesn't happen. It always goes from order and, you know, to chaos. That's the way of things. The kids are doing this environmental debate kind of stuff. And one of the cases is species. And we've lost a lot of species. Instead of having more and more species, we got less and less species as time goes on. It's going to a lower energy state. So have you ever had a battery that you've just let sit for a while, and then you go to use it, lost its energy? It's just a law of physics. It's called entropy, maximum randomness. Things always go from high energy state to low energy state. So the whole idea of creation is things go from low energy state to higher energy state. But that would violate, creation of life. That would violate the laws of physics. The only way things are going to go from a low energy state to a high energy state is if there's some force that's acting upon them. I wonder what that force could be. Okay, they point to a self-existing cause, something that was not caused. If everything has to be caused, where did it all come from? Maybe it came from something that's eternal. It can't have come from the universe because that's not eternal. So it must come from this thing that we call God. And let's see. Started seeking for some supernaturally authenticated revelation of the Creator. The piece I'm going to mention, number four, you'll never read, but it follows, just makes perfect sense, and this solves a lot of issues. In fact, some of them were talked about in praise time. But if there was a Creator with the power to create, would he also have the power to communicate? Gee, boss, I guess so. Yeah, right. So if he could create, you know, it's not a matter of power, he would be able to communicate. He would also be able to communicate in such a way that his creatures could understand him. Duh, that makes sense. And he would even have the power to be able to preserve that communication so we could understand it. Yep, follows. Now the question becomes, well, would he do it? Well, looking around us, we see purpose and order. And if there was a purpose and order reason for our existence here, and the Creator wanted to tell us about it, he could. Is it more reasonable to think that he would communicate or wouldn't communicate? Well, I don't know. Are there any claims in history that there's a Creator who's communicated? Well, yeah. Actually, there's this book that some people around here are studying, Book of Hebrews, and it says, you know, in the past, God spoke through the prophets, and now he's spoken through his Son. So, yeah, God, you know, we have this record that says, you know, done, put together by some people who could raise the dead and heal the sick and do other kinds of supernatural things. So that God spoke. So number four, created with the power to communicate, or create would certainly have the power to communicate and preserve in such a way that we could understand. And then he would particularly do that if we're held accountable to obeying the communication. He would make sure that it was given to us in a form that we could understand and comprehend and respond to. Even though inductive Bible study sometimes looks difficult, it actually eventually gets resolved. Just a little thing in history. You look at 10 classical authors, Caesar, Aristotle, Plato, Pliny, Herodotus, you know, any of these guys. In fact, I give excerpts to my students from all these guys. I say, oh yeah, look at these guys. And then I look at the next column. And most of you have seen the chart that I have on this. But it shows that we only have like average of 10, and that's being generous for some, copies of what these people originally wrote. So I said when I gave you Plato's Crito or I gave you Nicomachean Ethics from Aristotle, you had like less than 10 copies of this thing. And the oldest copy was that we have 1,000 years after the original was written. So we really aren't that sure that, you know, we have Plato's exact words because we've only got a few copies, handful or so, and there's a gap of 1,000 years between when the original was written and we have the manuscript in hand, which somebody used to translate the assignment I gave you. And we don't know how accurate these are. There's only one classical piece of literature that we have a bunch of copies of. It's called Homer's Iliad. And we put it all together and we say it's about 95% accurate. Then you look at this thing called the New Testament. I've got some numbers down there for you. Was it 24,000? There are 24,000 copies. Most of them are dated between 100 and 300 years after the original. We actually have some excerpts from the New Testament that are about 60 AD. It's a copy of an original that the original author was still alive. We have that copy from his time frame. It is the most historically authenticated, accurate piece of data. There's nothing like it. Apps by magnitude of 10. So it kind of makes sense that if there's a God who's communicating, he would have that stuff be accurate in such a way that we can understand it and preserve it and all that other good stuff. So I've done some other things on that on apologetics, so you can find those if you want. Speaking of things that are written, I do this little excerpt on Shakespeare could be created by a bunch of monkeys. Give them a million monkeys, a million typewriters, said George Bernard Shaw, and enough time, and they would pound out the complete works of Shakespeare. So I pulled up a spreadsheet and entered some numbers in to see, is this really true? I do this with my students on a board, and it's going to be a little hard to explain it, but I don't want to have to draw it out for you. But, you know, I say, how many letters you got in the alphabet? And most of my students get 26. I say, great. So give me some punctuation that I would need to write something. So I get a period and a question mark and a comma, and then some bright person thinks, space bar. Great. So now we got 30. It makes the math easy. So we give this monkey a typewriter, and we're going to see if he can type. We're going to give a million monkeys a million typewriters, and we're going to see if they could actually type out some of Shakespeare. So we kind of look at this, and I ask for a phrase, and I'll pick, all that glitters is not gold. You know, you all know that from Merchant of Venice. And the average number of characters in a word is like 4, and a space is 5. So if I wanted to type out all that glitters is, I'd kind of need like 20 characters. I'd have to get the monkeys to type 20 items in a row. You with me? So the chance of them hitting the A on the first time is 1 out of 30, because there are 30 possible keys for them to hit. The chance of them hitting the L is what? Don't answer, Garrett. I know you you actually had this in your first grade book. The chance of getting the L is 1 out of 30 as well. But the chance of getting the A and the L is 1 out of 900. 900. Because you have to go through all, you know, that's the probability, all right? So you multiply them together. That happens to be 30 to the second power. The chance of getting the first word, 4 letters, and into a space, is 30 to the fifth power. See how it works? The chance of getting all, you know, 20 characters in a row is 30 to the 20th power. So it's relatively simple math. Okay. Now the problem is monkeys, when you give them a typewriter, people have actually done this, they just kind of bang around the keys. But let's say we have really well-trained monkeys, and they don't hit all the keys. And then they take time out for banana breaks. You know, they're just horrible employees. You know? And if you're going to have a million monkeys typing, I mean, you think about it, well, we're going to see in a minute, it would never work. Not only do not hit the keys, but, you know, they got the monkey breaks, and then they got to make more monkeys, and that takes time, and they got to go to a monkey bar to meet the monkey. Yeah, they just never make this thing happen. But let's do just a theory. Let's see if it would work. And I think I have some numbers for you. A million monkeys typing on a million typewriters, and let's say they can use all their fingers, and I hope they have 10 fingers. I haven't counted. They have opposable thumbs. Yeah, okay, good. And let's say they can hit, you know, a key a second. Yeah, you know, 60 words a minute. You know, it's better than most of your administrative assistants. And we kind of calculate how many keys per day, and it's 864 with 3 zeros after it. And we eventually get up to, in a year, they could do 3, basically followed by 14 zeros. That's how many keys they could punch. That's a lot of keys. Okay. Now we're going to divide that into the number of keys that I have to press to, by chance, arrive at Shakespeare's play. So the first word is basically 30 to the fourth power, and they can basically do that in a second. Getting 2 words in a row, well, I got 10 characters there, That's actually going to take them about 2 days, or it should be actually 2 years. Yeah, that should actually be 2 years. My bad. To get four words in a row, that's going to be 30th to the 20th power divided by the monkey key number. And that's going to give me where's my answer there? One with 15 zeros after it. Years. That's older than the universe as far as I know. It's older than the known time. That's just to get four words in a row. Million monkeys typing. Someone actually said if you made every molecule in the universe a monkey, you still wouldn't get Shakespeare's works. Now, we have this stuff inside us called DNA. It's our life thing. I really like DNA because it's very much confirms the importance of disciple making for life. You have this strand of stuff. It's like four different kind of elements that go together, and it's wound around, and every single one of your cells has DNA in it, which tells the cells how to replicate itself. And the stuff uncoils, and it rips apart like a ladder, and then it replicates itself. And now you have two cells, and it can do this really, really fast. And you have a unique code. Each of your cells has that, but a code that makes up you. Hans told me that if you took your DNA code and typed it out on a sheet of paper like this, you would type this paper, another paper, another paper. By the time you finish typing out your DNA code, you would have a stack of papers as high as the Washington Monument. You're pretty complex. Someone said your DNA would stretch almost to the moon. It's like you're unbelievably complex. And we can't get four words in a row. DNA, someone said, it's 10 to the 600th power. Like that number just, we stop kind of grasping numbers when we get about 15 or 16. It's just like, it's huge. So what's the likelihood of it happening by chance? There is no likelihood. When I gave my students a quiz question on give me an argument for or against the existence of God, one of my students said, I'm not going to be able to get to the fossil stuff. They said, God and the scientists had a competition, a man-making competition. They said to God, we can make a man. And God said, okay, fine, let's have a contest. And they said, okay, give us some dirt and some water. God says, no, wait a minute, get your own dirt. This is one of my brighter students. It was good. So yeah, you got to have the building blocks. But I remember in high school, looking at the picture in the book, had a flask, those flasks that, they're clamped onto a stand and, okay. And then they were shooting it with, all kinds of x-rays and gamma rays and radiation, and probably everyone who did the experiment got cancer. But anyway, the eureka, the big news was that they had some primordial soup, which was basically some dirt and some mud and water, in that flask. And by subjecting it to enough radiation, they got two peptides to actually become a polypeptide, one of the building blocks of life. They got two of these things to jump together. Eureka! We've created life in a test tube. Oh, good, that explains it. Well, believe it or not, it wasn't until like 20 or 30, 25 years later when I was actually thinking about that again. Sometimes it takes me a while. And I thought, that can't be right. Because the very conditions that would cause those two things to jump together, massive radiation, the very next second would zap them, and guess what would happen? They'd fall apart. So not only do you have to kind of make the life, you have to make the means of sustaining it. So I can't get, we can't get four words to line up correctly, much less this thing that's, millions and millions and billions, it's incredibly complex to line up, to maintain itself, and to DNA actually is something called RNA that's necessary for replicating. You got all this stuff that just could not possibly happen by chance. So my final exam, give students basically a free 5-pointer at the end. I said, okay, tell me some stuff that you learned from the course that wasn't listed above. And one of my students wrote, I learned that monkeys can't type. This wasn't as bad as the battery guy. But most people, when presented with this kind of data, conclude, oh yeah, monkeys can't type, okay. No, no, no. What this means is life could not have been created by chance. It is just too complex. Well, since we're just about out of time, I think I'm not going to be able to do all the fun stuff on... I should do the science, one piece of science, and then the whole flood and fossils and Noah's Ark. Most of the questions, a lot of questions I get relate to Noah's Ark. But you might be able to explore some of the links, and we can talk about it more when we get together next time. But I share this quote with my students to indicate that science can actually be unscientific. The world's foremost evolutionary biologist, allegedly, is a guy called Richard Lewontin. He writes an article in the New York Review in 1997, reprinted by Answers in Genesis website, entitled Billions and Billions of Demons, in which he makes this incredible statement. And the in spites of and stuff like that, that are in italics, were his. And it goes like this. He says, we take the side of science in spite of the patent, obvious absurdity of some of its constructs. Construct is basically the way they construct things and put things together, like the dot explodes. We take the side of science in spite of its failure to fulfill any of its extravagant promises. So originally we thought science was going to save us and give a much higher quality of life and solve all the human problems. And the side I normally make is, yes, science has basically given us the capacity to kill each other at a much higher and effective rate. We take the side of science in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. You guys know what a just-so story is? Rudyard Kipling did a series of these. I know the children's librarian in her midst definitely knows these. She probably still reads them at night, doesn't let people know. One of my favorite ones is How the Elephant Got Its Nose. And that's what I tell my class. I'll give you the abbreviated version. Mommy elephant, baby elephant. Mommy elephant says to the baby elephant, don't go down in the water and drink while I'm not around because Mr. Crocodile's in there looking for lunch and he's going to bite your nose off and eat you. Being a baby elephant, like all good baby elephants, as soon as mommy's back is turned, what does he do? He goes down to the water to drink. And Mr. Crocodile was waiting for lunch. And he goes out and gloms on baby elephant's nose and starts pulling him in to have baby elephant soup. Baby elephant cries out, Mommy, Mommy, help me! Yeah, Mommy elephant runs over, wraps her trunk around baby's elephant legs and starts trying to pull him back out. And she's a tug of war with Mr. Crocodile. Mr. Crocodile's on the nose. Mommy elephant's on the back, and the baby elephant's getting a little stretched out. So in their tug of war, you know, Mr. Crocodile has some friends that come over because they want a little bite of baby elephant because baby elephant's delicious from what I've heard. And you guys have that on your trip? Anyway, he starts pulling them in, and Mommy elephant calls for help, and the whole herd comes and wraps their trunks around her, and baby elephant is really now in a tug of war. And do you know what happens to baby elephant's nose? It gets longer and longer and longer. And then the story concludes with, and that's why all elephants have long noses. Amazing. So this, you know, environmental accident has now changed the baby's DNA so that all future elephants are going to have elongated noses. They've got other stories like how the elephant got its stripes and stuff like that. You know, that probably would make a good science curriculum. It's about based about as much as some of the science stuff I've seen. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Oh, wait, but I actually have reason for saying that. Because look what happens next. So we take the side of science in spite of its tolerance or whatever for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Those are his words. By the way, this guy happens to be a Marxist as well, which means he's a big believer in communism. Why? Why would you do such silliness? Well, because we have a priori, that means prior, before we even step into the room to look at things, we have an a priori commitment. And that commitment is to materialism. Remember I started this with material and material world? We have this commitment to materialism. It's only the stuff you can see, count, measure, and get grants to study. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation for the phenomenal world. It's basically, it's not like science has basically been objectively done and now has caused us to arrive at this conclusion that said we have a material world. No, 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 no. But on the contrary, his words again, we are forced, I don't know who's forcing them to do this, by our a priori adherence to material causes. So they want to get, they have this a priori commitment, we're only going to find material causes, to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. In other words, science is rigged. We're only going to find material things because that's all we're going to look for. And we're going to do this no matter how counterintuitive, that means it really doesn't make sense, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, which means you have to go through the PhD ceremony where you put your biases and brains and objectivity on hold in order to get the union card to be able to teach in universities down the road. And moreover, that commitment to materialism is an absolute. Why? We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. I mean, this really goes to show or prove my case that scientists are just a little dense on some things. If I believe this, I would never go and print with it. It's like, he's admitting it's a fraud. At least the scientists who who kind of got in that email hassle and went to try to illegally retrieve their and destroy the evidence because they kind of knew this was bad. But this guy actually went on record. It's kind of like in your face. It's like science is rigged. And people are going to say, I'm going to put all my faith in science. Wait a minute, it's counterintuitive. It's unreasonable. It doesn't make sense. Anybody who's thought about it says it's crazy. And you're buying into it. Gee, I wonder why. Okay, I'm not going to be able to do the fossil stuff. I'll do that the next time we get together. I can kind of expand it. But the idea behind fossils is everything in the fossil record, everything that we see in our world points to the fact that there was creation, there was a flood. It explains the data. And one of the things you can think about between now and the next time we get together to do this is how do you catch a woolly mammoth and how do you fossilize a jellyfish? A woolly mammoth, it's a tropical animal. They find them totally encased in ice in the Arctic with stomachs full of food in perfect condition. You can actually eat the flesh, they said. It tastes a little woolly. And it actually has flowers in their mouth. So how do you get, it's like between your teeth, they didn't floss, so we know that much. How do you catch a woolly mammoth in ice and preserve it? And then how do you fossilize a jellyfish? Now, you Jersey people, if you go down to the shore in the morning, you find jellyfish along the shore. You never find them in the afternoon. And you have to figure out why, and then you have to figure out how you fossilize it. So all those questions will be answered at some other time. But I will address any questions that you have from the stuff I said earlier. Any? Yes, Vince.
You're kind of saying science is crazy and...
not all science, but...
At best, in some cases, it's fraudulent, but I think you'd also say there's a role for science and
a very
important fact force in terms of understanding truth and that type of thing.
Oh, yeah, I'm all for science. As it's legitimate, there's good science, and we profit greatly from it. If it wasn't for science, we wouldn't have electricity, and if we didn't have electricity, I'd be surfing the internet in the dark. Yeah, Steve.
Don't a lot of scientists, when they take surveys, don't they believe in some sort of creator? I thought the majority believe it. They may not admit it, but they believe it, but they want to attribute to it. God.
Yeah, I think a lot of them do it, but they have to be really careful because if they like eating, they can't say that. So atheists compose less than 10% of the population, but 20% of the faculty parking lots are driven by atheists. So it's double the normal amount. That means 80% of them are some sort of theists. However, if you come out with something that goes against the scientific community, listen to Dr. Wally Soon. It was unbelievable. He's published all these things. He teams up with a guy who has a 100% acceptance rate with his proposals, and now because he's published something that's against the party line, he can't get any money to do any research. So everybody wants to duck and cover. And they don't want to really stand on what the scriptures say because I can do the same kind of thing with the way people handle scripture. You know, they don't look at it. They're not reasonable. Their systems don't make sense. So yeah, so you're not going to, they're basically just going to keep quiet about it and say, well, yeah, it looks more like this. There's a thing I'm going to do a little later on dating, not the courtship marriage kind of dating, but the dating and ages of things. And someone's assembled a quote book. I think the Answers and Generous people have this, and it might even be in the online Bible, of 5,000 and counting quotes from scientists saying that this stuff doesn't make sense. But only 150 of them claim to have any faith. So you have 4,000, math used to be 150, scientists that basically are saying, well, this stuff is bogus. So they will say it, but they've got to say it really carefully. And they have to, if you saw the movie Expelled, I didn't see it, but with the reviews of it, their jobs are basically on the line.
Bill,
yeah, Barbara.
I understand point five. I understand that the point about the environment could not have formed an amino acid yet that would have been destroyed by the radiation. But going back to the monkey's hand type, I don't quite understand the relevance of this to the argument either way, because I think, from what I understand, the belief of evolutionists is that we all were created, in other words, life began with an amoeba in the primeval muck, after this Big Bang theory. And so these amoebas went from a lower form to a higher form. And I know you've got a point that disputes that later. But what is the relevance of the monkey can't type?
Okay.
To their way of thinking, if an atheist were sitting here, he would say, until the monkeys evolved into the Homo sapien type, then there was no capability of language.
Well, an amoeba has some complexity. So how do you get the amoeba? To get the amoeba, you have to say it's a product of chance. Even if you go directly from the dot, gave you the universe and all the muck and the amoebas. Though you had to have some things that kind of get next to each other and form a DNA chain. All life has this DNA. Every cell's got it. So there has to be some sort of order for it. In order to form one of these things, you have to have two things that are next to each other that somehow manage to link up. And then they just have to get a couple extra billion to join them in an orderly fashion to make the thing. So the thing is, given time and chance, you can have life forms develop. If you have the ingredients. Well, first of all, you can't have the ingredients because there's all kinds of reasons that tell you that can't happen. But all this stuff happened just by chance over time. And I left out the fact that the universe, the largest date for the universe is, I think, 3.75 times 10 to the 6th years. That's almost 14 billion so years old. There's just not enough time for this stuff to happen. We have to get four things in a row.
Or for the monkeys to die.
Yeah, you can't get the building blocks to actually build.
Uh-huh.
They won't do it by chance.
Okay, thank you.
There's got to be some force going first against entropy and first against probability to make this stuff happen. It would take a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, Garrett.
I recently read a book, and it's called Just Six Numbers, and it shows how many of the quantities in a universe that determine natural laws, for example, the relationship of gravity versus the molecular force, how extremely intricate these are designed so that life is possible. If one of these six numbers would be off by just 1% or so in either direction, there would not be material, there would not be life, there would be no universe, there would be anything. So the guy who wrote it, this is 100% atheist. He says it's amazing how designed our universe seems to be. So the only way that I can explain this is that there are unlimited amounts of universes, and this one just happens to have all these right quantities so that life was possible.
Right,
so
and now
you got that much randomness.
Yeah, so basically they take this whole argument of randomness even a step further. So there must be an unlimited amount of universes, because otherwise this would not be possible. It's almost like your sentence here, just any solution we accept as long as there's no God involved.
And why do they not want a God involved? When Mortimer Adler wrote his book about how to think about God, he was an atheist. He remained an atheist. I found an interview on the internet that was done with him about 10 or 15 years later, in which he became a theist, actually became a Christian. And he said, my reasons for not buying it were not philosophical, intellectual, or scientific. They were moral. I basically wanted to do what I wanted to do. And that is what you find every honestish atheist basically saying. Food here? Almost? Okay, so let's pray and I'll come back and revisit the fossils another time. Thank you, Father, that our faith is built on truth, on reason that is irrefutable. Thank you that you are the God who is truth, and your spirit of truth has recorded words for us that we can trust and rely upon. Thank you for giving us the capacity to understand it. Thanks for giving a world that we can explore and things that we can develop because it comes from the order and pattern of a divine intelligence. Thank you also that all the commands that you give us originate from the same source. The things that you tell us to do or not do are also for our best. They're also true. They're also reliable. Help us live in light of them. Please you, in Christ's name. Amen.
Okay, quickly, next week is the white elephant.